and always had the power to impose losses on even the senior bondholders if it wanted to. Senior people have forgotten that the government has certain powers, as Morgan Kelly puts it. You can conscript people. You can send them off to certain death. You can change the law. On September 30, 2008, in the heat of the moment, Lenihan gave the same argument for guaranteeing the bank's debts as Merrill Lynch, to prevent contagion. Tell financial markets that a loan to an Irish bank was a loan to the Irish government, and investors would calm down, for who would doubt the credit of the Irish government? A few months later, when suspicions arose that the bank losses were so vast that they might bankrupt the Irish government, Lenihan offered a new reason for the government's gift to private investors. The bonds were owned by Irish savings banks. Up until then, the government's line had been that they did not have any idea who owned the bank's bonds. Now they said that if the Irish government didn't eat the losses, Irish savers would pay the price. The Irish, in other words, were simply saving the Irish. This wasn't true. It provoked a cry of outrage from the Irish savings banks, who said they didn't own the bonds, and that they disapproved of the government's bestowing a huge gift on those who did. A financial investigative blog called Guido Fox somehow obtained a list of the foreign bondholders: German banks, French banks, German investment funds, Goldman Sachs. Yes, even the Irish did their bit for Goldman. Across Europe just now, men who thought their title was Minister of Finance have woken up to the idea that their job is actually government bond salesman. The Irish bank losses have obviously bankrupted Ireland, but the Irish finance minister does not want to talk about that. Instead, he mentions to me several times that Ireland is fully funded until next summer. That is, the Irish government has enough cash in the bank to pay its bills until next July. It isn't until I'm on my way out the door that I realize how trivial this point is. The blunt truth is that since September 2008, Ireland has been every day more at the mercy of her creditors. To remain afloat, Ireland's banks, which are now owned by the Irish government, have taken short-term loans from the European Central Bank of 85 billion euros. Inside of a week, Lenihan will be compelled by the European Union to invite the IMF into Ireland, relinquish control of Irish finances, and accept a bailout package. The Irish public doesn't yet know it, but even as the Minister of Finance and I sit together at his conference table, the European Central Bank has lost interest in lending to Irish banks, and soon Brian Lenihan will stand up in the Irish Parliament and offer a fourth explanation for why private investors in Ireland's banks cannot be allowed to take losses. There is simply no way that this country, whose banks are so dependent on international investors, can unilaterally renege on senior bondholders against the wishes of the ECB, he will say. But there was once a time when the wishes of the ECB didn't matter so much to Ireland. That time was before the Irish government used ECB money to pay off the foreign bondholders in Irish banks. Once a decade, I experiment with driving on the wrong side of the road and wind up destroying dozens of side-view mirrors on cars parked on the left. When I went looking for some Irish person to drive me around, the result was a fellow I will call Ian McRory, who is Irish and a driver, but pretty clearly a lot of other things, too. He has what appears to be a military-grade navigational system, for instance, and surprising knowledge about abstruse and secretive matters. "I do some personal security and things of that nature," he says when I ask him what else he does other than drive financial disaster tourists back and forth across Ireland, and leaves it at that. Later, when I mention the name of a formerly rich Irish property developer, he says casually, as if it were all in a day's work, that he had let himself into the fellow's vacation house and snap photographs of the interior for a man I know who is thinking of buying it. Ian turns out to have a good feel for what little I or anyone else might find interesting in rural Ireland. He will say, for example, "Over there, that's a pretty typical fairy ring," and then explain, interestingly, that these circles of stones or mushrooms that occur seemingly naturally in Irish fields are believed by local farmers to house mythical creatures. "Irish people actually believe in fairies?" I will ask, straining but failing to catch a glimpse of the typical fairy ring to which Ian has just pointed. I mean, if you walked right up and asked him to his face, "Do you believe in fairies?" most guys will deny it, he will reply. But if you ask him to dig out the fairy ring on his property, he won't do it. To my way of thinking, that's believing. And it is. It's a tactical belief, a belief that exists because the upside to disbelief is too small, like the former Irish belief that Irish land prices could rise forever. The highway out of Dublin runs past abandoned building sites and neighborhoods without people in them. "We can stop at ghost estates on the way," says Ian as we clear the suburbs of Dublin, "but if we stop at every one of them, we'll never get out of here." We pass wet green fields carved by potato farmers into small plots, and every now and then a small village, but even the inhabited places feel desolate. The Irish countryside remains a place people flee. Among its drawbacks, from the outsider's point of view, is the weather. "It's always either raining or about to rain," says Ian. "I drove a black guy from Africa around the country once. It's raining the whole time." He says to me, "I don't know why people live here. It's like living under an elephant." The wet hedgerows cultivated along the highway to hide the wet road from the wet houses now hide the wet houses from the wet road. "Picture of the village of the future," reads a dripping billboard with a picture of a village that will never be built. Randomly selecting a village that appears to be more or less finished, we pull off the road. It's an exurb without a suburb. "Glen Riada," reads the self-important sign in front. It's a few dozen houses in a field, attached to nothing but each other, ending with unoccupied slabs of concrete buried in weeds. You can see the moment the money stopped flowing from the Irish banks, the developer folded his tent, and the Polish workers went home. "The guy who laid this didn't even believe it was supposed to be finished," says Ian. The concrete slab, like the completed houses, is riven by the cracks that you see in a house after a major earthquake, but which in this case are caused by carelessness. Inside, the floors are littered with trash and debris, the fixtures have been ripped out of the kitchen, and mold spreads spider-like across the walls. The last time I saw an interior like this was in New Orleans after Katrina. Ireland's Department of the Environment published its first audit of the country's new housing stock in 2009 after inspecting 2,846 housing developments, many of them ghost estates. The government granted planning permission for 180,000 units, of which more than 100,000 are unoccupied. Some of those that are occupied remain unfinished. Virtually all construction has now ceased. There aren't enough people in Ireland to fill the new houses. There were never enough people in Ireland to fill the new houses. Ask Irish property developers who they imagined was going to live in the Irish countryside, and they all laugh the same uneasy laugh and offer up the same list of prospects. Poles, foreigners looking for second homes, entire departments of Irish government workers who would be shipped to the sticks in a massive planned relocation plan that somehow never materialized. The diaspora of 70 million human beings with some genetic link to Ireland. The problem that no one paid all that much attention to during the boom was that people from outside Ireland, even those with a genetic link to the place, have no interest in owning houses in Ireland. "This isn't an international property market," says an agent at Seville's Dublin branch named Ronan O'Driscoll. There aren't any foreign buyers. There were never foreign buyers. Dublin was never London. The Irish countryside will never be the Cotswolds. Which way entire nations jumped when the money was made freely available to them obviously told you a lot about them. Their desires, their constraints, their secret sense of themselves. How they reacted when the money was taken away was equally revealing. In Greece, the money was borrowed by the state. The debts are the debts of the Greek people, but the people want no part of them. The Greeks have already taken to the streets violently and have been quick to find people outside of Greece to blame for their problems, monks, Turks, foreign bankers. Greek anarchists now mail bombs to German politicians and hurl Molotov cocktails at their own police. In Ireland, the money was borrowed by a few banks, and yet the people seem not only willing to repay it, but to do so without so much as a small moan. Back in the autumn of 2008, after the government threatened to means test the medical care, the old people had marched in the streets of Dublin. A few days after I'd arrived, the students followed suit, but their protest was less public anger than theater, and perhaps an excuse to skip school. "Down with this sort of thing," read one of the students' signs. I'd tapped two students as they stumbled away from the event to ask them why they had all painted yellow streaks onto their faces. They looked at each other for a beat. "Dunno," one finally said, and burst out laughing. Other than that, silence. It's more than 3 years since the Irish government foisted the losses of the Irish banks on the Irish people, and in that time, there have been only two conspicuous acts of Irish social unrest. In early 2009, at AIB's first shareholder meeting after the collapse, a senior citizen hurled rotten eggs at the bank's executives, and late one night in September 2010, a property developer from Galway named Joe McNamara painted his cement mixer with anti-banker slogans, climbed inside the cab, drove across the country, and after locking its brakes and disabling the release, stalled the machine between the gates of the Parliament. The elderly egg thrower was a distant memory, but McNamara was still more or less in the news, declining requests for interviews. "Joe is a private person," his lawyer told me. "Joe feels like he's made his point. He doesn't want any media attention." Before he'd parked his cement mixer in the Parliament's driveway, McNamara had been a small-time builder. He'd started out laying foundations, and like a lot of tradesmen from the sticks, he'd been given a loan by Anglo-Irish Bank. Thus began his career as a property developer. He'd moved to Galway into a tacky new development beside a golf course, but the source of his financial distress lay an hour or so beyond the city, in a resort hotel he'd tried to build in the tiny village in which he'd grown up, called Keel, on a remote island called Achill. "Achill," says Ian, after I tell him that's where I'd like him to drive me, then goes silent for a minute, as if giving me time to reconsider. "This time of year, Achill's going to be fairly bleak," he thinks another minute. "Mind you, in the summer, it can be fairly bleak as well." It's twilight as we roll across the tiny bridge and onto the island. On either side of the snaking single-lane road, peat bogs stretch as far as the eye can see. The feel is less tourist destination than end of the earth. "The next stop is Newfoundland," says Ian. The Achill Head Hotel, Joe's first venture, still run by his ex-wife, was closed and dark. But there, smack in the middle of the tiny village of his hometown of Keel, was the source of all of Joe McNamara's financial troubles, a giant black hole surrounded by bulldozers and materials. He'd set out in 2005 to build a modest one-story hotel with 12 rooms. In April 2006, with the Irish property market exploding, he had expanded his ambition and applied for permission to build a multi-story luxury hotel. At exactly that moment, the market turned. We went away in June of 2006, Ronan O'Driscoll, the Savills broker, told me. We came back in September, and everything had just stopped. How does everyone decide at once that it's time to stop? That it's become mad? For the past 4 years, the hotel site had scarred the village. But it wasn't until May 2010 that Anglo-Irish Bank, which had lent McNamara the money to develop it, threatened to force him into receivership. Irish bankruptcy laws were not designed for spectacular failure, perhaps because the people who wrote them never imagined spectacular success. When a bank forces an Irish person into receivership, it follows up with a letter to his blood relations, informing them of his insolvency and his shame. A notice of the bankruptcy is published in one national and one local newspaper. For as many as 12 years, the Irish bankrupt is not permitted to take out a loan for more than €650, or to own assets amounting to more than €3,100, or to travel abroad without government permission. For 12 years, part of what he earns may pass directly to his creditors. It's not like the United States, where being bankrupt is almost a badge of honor, says Patrick White of the Irish Property Council. Here, you are effectively disbarred from commercial life. There's an ancient rule of financial life. If you owe the bank $5 million, the bank owns you. But if you owe the bank $5 billion, you own the bank. That newly applies to Ireland. The debts of Ireland's big property developers, defined as anyone who owed the bank more than €20 million, are now being worked out behind closed doors. In exchange for helping the government to manage or liquidate their real estate portfolios, the biggest failures have been spared bankruptcy. Smaller developers like McNamara are in a far harder place. And while no one seems to know how many of these people exist, the number is clearly big. Ireland's National Asset Management Agency controls roughly €80 billion worth of commercial property loans. An Irish property expert named Peter Bacon, who advised NAMA when it was created, recently revealed that when he'd added up the smaller Irish property-related loans, those under €20 million, they amounted to another €80 billion. Some very large number of former Irish tradesmen are in exactly Joe McNamara's situation. Some very large number of Irish homeowners are in something very like it. The difference between McNamara and everyone else is that he had complained about it publicly, but then, apparently, had genuinely thought better of it. I'd tracked down and phoned his ex-wife, who just laughed and told me to get lost. I finally reached McNamara himself, ambushing him on his cell phone, but he only muttered something about not wanting to draw further attention to himself, then hung up. It was only after I texted him to say I was en route to his hometown that he became sufficiently aroused to communicate. "What are you doing in Kiel?" he hollered by text message more than once. "Tell me, why are you going to Kiel?" Then once again he fell silent. The problem with the Irish people, Ian says as we drive away from the black hole that bankrupted Joe McNamara, is that you can push them and push them and push them. But when they break, they go wacko. A month later, after a period of silence, McNamara would reappear, screaming from the top of a building crane that he had driven across the country and ditched, once again, in front of the Parliament. Two things strike every Irish person when he comes to America, Irish friends tell me: the vastness of the country and the seemingly endless desire of its people to talk about their personal problems. Two things strike an American when he comes to Ireland: how small it is and how tight-lipped. An Irish person with a personal problem takes it into a hole with him, like a squirrel with a nut before winter. He tortures himself and sometimes his loved ones, too. What he doesn't do, if he has suffered some reversal, is vent about it to the outside world. The famous Irish gift of gab is a cover for all the things they aren't telling you. So far as I could see by November 10, 2010, the population of Irish people willing to make a stink about what was happening to them had been reduced to one, the egg thrower. The next day we pull up outside his home, a modest old row house on the outskirts of Dublin. The cheery elderly gentleman who opens the door in a neat burgundy sweater and well-pressed slacks has, among his other qualities, fantastically good manners. He has the ability to seem pleased even when total strangers ring his doorbell and to make them feel welcome. On the table in Gary Keogh's small and tidy dining room is a book created by his grandchildren, dated May 2009. Granddad's Excellent Adventure, it is called. In the months after Brian Lenihan's bank bailout, Keogh, for the first time in his life, began to pay attention to the behavior of Irish bankers. His own shares in AIB, once thought to be as sound as cash or gold, were rapidly becoming worthless. But the bank's executives exhibited not the first hint of remorse or shame. AIB's chairman, Dermot Gleeson, and its CEO, Eugene Sheehy, troubled him the most. The two of them stood up time and again and said, "Our bank is 100% sound," explains Keogh, as if nothing at all was the matter. He set out to learn more about these people in whom he had always placed blind trust. What he found, high pay, corporate boondoggles, outraged him further. The chairman paid himself $475,000 to chair 12 meetings, he still shouts. What Keogh learned remains both the most shocking and the most familiar aspect of the Irish catastrophe: how easily ancient financial institutions abandon their traditions and principles. An upstart bank, Anglo-Irish, had entered their market and professed to have found a new and better way to be a banker. Anglo made incredibly quick decisions. An Irish property developer could walk into Anglo's office in the late afternoon with a new idea and walk out with hundreds of millions of euros the same night. Anglo was able to shovel money out its door so quickly because it had turned banking into a family affair. If they liked the man, they didn't bother to evaluate his project. Rather than point out the insanity of the approach, the two old Irish banks simply caved to it. An Irish businessman named Dennis O'Brien sat on the board of the Bank of Ireland in 2005 when it was faced with the astonishing growth of Anglo-Irish. Anglo-Irish was about to double in size in just 2 years. "I remember the CEO coming in and saying, 'We're going to grow at 30% a year,'" O'Brien told me. I said, "How the fuck are you going to do that? Banking is a 5 to 7% a year growth business at best." They did it by doing what Anglo-Irish had done: writing checks to Irish property developers to buy Irish land at any price. AIB, which had paid its lending officers based on how much money they lent, opened a unit nicknamed ABA, anybody but Anglo, dedicated to poaching Anglo's biggest property developer clients, the very people who would become the most spectacular busts in Irish history. In October 2008, the Irish Times published a list of the 5 biggest real estate deals from the past 3 years. Allied Irish lent the money for 10 of the 15, Anglo-Irish for just 1. On Irish national radio, the insolvent property developer Simon Kelly, who personally owes 200 million euros to various Irish banks and who belongs to a partnership that owes another 2 billion euros, confessed that the only time in his career a banker became upset with him was when he repaid a loan to Anglo-Irish with money borrowed from Allied Irish. the former Anglo-Irish executives I interviewed, off the record as they are all in hiding, speak of their older, more respectable imitators with a kind of amazement. "Yes, we were out of control," they say in so many words, "but those guys were fucking nuts." Gary Keogh thought about how Ireland had changed from his youth when the country was dirt poor. "I used to collect bottle caps," he said. "Now the health service doesn't even bother to take back crutches anymore. No, we're far too wealthy." Unlike most people he knew, Keogh had no debts. "I had nothing to lose," he says. "I didn't owe anyone any money. That's why I could do it." He'd also just recovered from a serious illness and felt a bit as if he was playing with house money. "I had just got a new kidney and I was very pleased with it," he says. "But I think it must have been Che Guevara's kidney." He describes his elaborate plot the way an assassin might describe the perfect hit. "I only had 2 rotten eggs," he says, "but by God, they were rotten, because I kept them 6 weeks in the garage." The AIB shareholders meeting of March 2009 was the first he'd ever attended. He was, he admits, a bit worried something might go wrong. Worried parking might be a problem, he took the bus. Worried that his eggs might break, he designed a container to protect them. Worried that he didn't even know what the room looked like, he left himself time to case the meeting hall. "I got to the front door early and had a little recce," as he puts it, "just to see what was going to happen." His egg container was too large to sneak inside, so he ditched it. "I had 1 egg in each jacket pocket," he says. Worried that his eggs might be too slippery to grip and throw, he'd wrapped each of them in a thin layer of cellophane. "I positioned myself 4 rows back and 4 seats in," he says. "Not too close, but not too far." Then he waited for his moment. It came immediately. Right after the executives took their place at the dais, a shareholder stood up, uninvited, to ask a question. Gleason, AIB's chairman, barked, "Sit down!" "He thought he was a dictator," says Keogh, who had heard enough. He rose to his feet and shouted, "I've listened to enough of your crap! You're a fucking bastard!" And then he began firing. He thought he had been shot, he says now with a little smile, because the first egg hit the microphone and went pow. The first egg splattered onto the shoulder pad of Gleason's suit. The second egg missed the CEO, but nailed the AIB sign behind him. Then the security guards were on him. "I was told I would be arrested and charged, but I never was," he says. Of course he wasn't. This was, at bottom, a family dispute. The guards wanted to escort him out, but he actually left the place on his own and climbed aboard the next bus home. "The incident happened at 10:10 in the morning," he says. "I was home by 10:11. At 10:11, the phone rang, and I was on the radio for an hour." Then, but briefly, all was madness. "The press descended on the house and they wouldn't get out," he says. It didn't really matter. He wasn't sticking around. He'd done exactly what he planned to do and saw no need to make a further fuss. He flew out of Dublin Airport at 6 the next morning for a long-planned Mediterranean cruise. Part 4. The Secret Lives of Germans. By the time I arrived in Hamburg in the summer of 2011, the fate of the financial universe seemed to turn on which way the German people jumped. Moody's was set to downgrade the Portuguese government's debt to junk bond status, and Standard & Poor's had hinted darkly that Italy might be next. Ireland was about to be downgraded to junk status too, and there was a very real possibility that the newly elected Spanish government might seize the moment to announce that the old Spanish government had miscalculated and owed foreigners a lot more money than they previously imagined. Then there was Greece, Of the 126 countries with rated debt, Greece was now ranked 126th. The Greeks were officially regarded as the least likely people on the planet to repay their debts. As the Germans were not only the biggest creditor of the various deadbeat European nations, but their only serious hope for future funding, it was left to the Germans to act as moral arbiter, to decide which financial behaviors would be tolerated and which would not. As a senior official at the Bundesbank put it to me, "If we say no, it's no. Nothing happens without Germany. This is where the losses come to live." Just a year ago, when German public figures called Greeks cheaters, or German magazines ran headlines like, "Why don't you sell your islands, you bankrupt Greeks?" ordinary Greeks took it as an outrageous insult. In June of 2011, the Greek government started selling islands, or at any rate created a fire sale list of thousands of properties, golf courses, beaches, airports, farmlands, roads, that they hoped to auction in order to help repay their debts. It's safe to say that the idea of doing this had not come from the Greeks. To no one but a German is Hamburg an obvious place to spend a vacation. But it happened to be a German holiday, and Hamburg was overrun by German tourists. When I asked the hotel concierge what there was to see in his city, he had to think for a few seconds before he said, "Most people just go to the Reeperbahn." The Reeperbahn is Hamburg's red light district, the largest red light district in the world, according to one guidebook, though you have to wonder how anyone figured that out. And the Reeperbahn, as it happens, was why I was there. Perhaps because they have such a gift for creating difficulties with non-Germans, the Germans have been on the receiving end of many scholarly attempts to understand their collective behavior. In this vast and growing enterprise, a small book with a funny title towers over many larger, more ponderous ones. Written in the early 1980s by a distinguished American anthropologist named Alan Dundee, "Life is Like a Chicken Coop Ladder," set out to describe the German character through the stories that ordinary Germans like to tell one another. Dundee specialized in folklore, and in German folklore, as he put it, one finds an inordinate number of texts concerning Scheiße, shit, Dreck, dirt, Mist, manure, Arsch, ass. Folk songs, folk tales, proverbs, riddles, folk speech, all attest to the Germans' long-standing special interest in this area of human activity. He proceeded to pile up a shockingly high stack of evidence to support his theory. There's a popular German folk character called Der Dukatenscheiße, the money shitter, who is commonly depicted crapping coins from his rear end. The world's first museum devoted exclusively to toilets is in Munich. A second has opened in New Delhi. The German word for shit performs a vast number of bizarre linguistic duties. For instance, a common German term of endearment once was "my little shitbag." The first thing Gutenberg sought to publish after the Bible was a laxative timetable he called a purgation calendar. Then there is the astonishing number of anal German folk sayings. "As the fish lives in water, so does the shit stick to the asshole," to select but one of the seemingly endless examples. Dundee caused a bit of a stir, for an anthropologist, by tracking this single low national character trait into the most important moments in German history. The fiercely scatological Martin Luther, "I am like ripe shit, and the world is a gigantic asshole," Luther once explained, had the idea that launched the Protestant Reformation while sitting on the John. Mozart's letters revealed a mind, as Dundee put it, whose indulgence in fecal imagery may be virtually unmatched. Hitler's favorite word was Scheißkerl, shithead. He apparently used it to describe not only other people, but himself as well. After the war, Hitler's doctors told U.S. intelligence officers that their patient had devoted surprising energy to examining his own feces, and there was pretty strong evidence that one of his favorite things to do with women was to have them poop on him. Perhaps Hitler was so persuasive to Germans, Dundee suggested, because he shared their quintessential trait, a public abhorrence of filth that masked a private obsession. The combination of clean and dirty, clean exterior, dirty interior, or clean form and dirty content, is very much a part of the German national character, he wrote. Dundee confined himself mainly to the study of Low German culture. For those hoping to examine coprophilia in German high culture, he recommended another book by a pair of German scholars called The Call of Human Nature, The Role of Scatology in Modern German Literature. Still, it was hard to come away from his treatise without the strong sense that all Germans, high and low, were a bit different from you and me, a point he made in the introduction to the paperback version of his book. The American wife of a German-born colleague confessed to me that she understood her husband much better after reading the book, he wrote. Prior to that time, she had wrongly assumed that he must have some kind of peculiar psychological hang-up, inasmuch as he insisted upon discussing at great length the state of his latest bowel movement. The Hamburg red light district had caught Dundee's eye, because the locals made such a big deal of mud wrestling. Naked women fought in a ring of filth, while the spectators wore plastic caps, a sort of head condom, to avoid being splattered. Thus, wrote Dundee, the audience can remain clean while enjoying dirt. Germans long to be near the shit, but not in it. This, as it turns out, is an excellent description of their role in the current financial crisis. A week earlier in Berlin, I had gone to see Germany's Deputy Minister of Finance, a 44-year-old career government official named Jörg Asmussen. The Germans now are in possession of the only finance ministry in the big-time developed world whose leaders don't need to worry whether their economy will collapse the moment investors stop buying their bonds. As unemployment in Greece climbs to the highest on record, 16.2% at last count, it falls in Germany to 20-year lows, 6.9%. Germany appears to have experienced a financial crisis without economic consequences. They donned head condoms in the presence of their bankers and avoided being splattered by their mud. As a result, for the past year or so, the financial markets have been trying and failing to get a read on the German people. They can obviously afford to pay off the debts of their fellow Europeans, but will they actually do it? Are they now Europeans, or are they still Germans? Any utterance or gesture by any German official anywhere near this decision for the past 18 months has been a market-moving headline, and there have been plenty of them, most of them echoing German public opinion and expressing incomprehension and outrage that other people can behave so irresponsibly. Asmussen is one of the Germans now being obsessively watched. Along with his boss, Wolfgang Schäuble, he's one of two German officials present in every conversation between the German government and the deadbeats. The finance ministry, built in the mid-1930s, is a monument to both the Nazis' ambition and their taste. A faceless butte, it is so big that if you circle it in the wrong direction, it can take you 20 minutes to find the front door. I circle it in the wrong direction, then sweat and huff to make up for lost time, all the while wondering if provincial Nazis in from the sticks had the same experience, wandering outside these forbidding stone walls trying to figure out how to get in. At length, I find a familiar-looking courtyard. The only difference between its appearance now and in famous old photographs is that Hitler is no longer marching in and out of the entryway, and the statue of the eagle perched atop the swastika has been removed. It was built for Goering's Air Ministry, says the waiting finance ministry public relations man, who is, oddly enough, French. You can tell from the cheerful architecture. He explains that the building is so big because Hermann Göring wanted to be able to land planes on its roof. I have arrived about 3 minutes late, but the German deputy minister of finance runs a full 5 minutes later, which I will learn is viewed by Germans almost as a felony. He apologizes a great deal more than he needs to for the delay. He wears the slender framed spectacles of a German film director and is extremely fit and bald, but by choice rather than circumstance. Extremely fit white men who shave their heads are making a statement in my experience of them. I don't need body fat, and I don't need hair, they seem to be saying, while also implying that anyone who does is a wuss. The deputy finance minister even laughs, just as all extremely fit men with shaved heads should laugh, if they want to remain in character. Instead of opening his mouth to allow the air to pass, he purses his lips and snorts the sound out through his nose. He may need laughter as much as other men, but he needs less air to laugh with. His desk is a template of self-discipline, alive with implied activity, legal pads, post-it notes, manila folders. Every single object on it is perfectly aligned with all the others and with the edges of the desk. Every angle is precisely 90 degrees. But the most striking optional decor is a big white sign on the wall beside the desk. It's in German, but translates easily back into the original English. The secret of success is to understand the point of view of others. Henry Ford. This surprises me. It's not at all what an extremely fit bald man should have as his mantra. It's soft. The deputy German finance minister further disturbs my wild assumptions about him by speaking clearly, even recklessly, about subjects most finance ministers assume it is their job to obscure. He offers up without much prompting that he has just finished reading the latest unpublished report by IMF investigators on the progress made by the Greek government in reforming itself. They have not implemented the measures they have promised to implement, he says simply. They are not making the agreed-upon reforms. The people at the IMF put it that clearly, I ask. He turns to page 7 of the IMF report, where it recommends not giving the Greeks the next tranche of the money the government needs to avoid defaulting on its bonds. They have a massive problem still with revenue collection. Not the tax law itself, it's the collection which needs to be overhauled. The Greeks are still refusing to pay their taxes, in other words, but it is only one of many Greek sins. Their labor market isn't changing as it needs to. I ask him for an example. They had very clearly, as a tradition, a 13th or 14th monthly salary, he says instantly. Due to developments in the last 10 years, a similar civil service job in Germany pays 55,000 euros. In Greece, it is 70,000. To get around pay restraints in the calendar year, the Greek government simply paid employees for months that didn't exist. They need to change the relationship of the people to the government, he continues. It is not a task that can be done in 3 months. Changing the relationship between any people and its government, he added, was not a trivial matter. The Greeks needed to change their culture. He couldn't have put this more bluntly. If the Greeks and the Germans were to coexist in a currency union, the Greeks needed to change who they are. This is unlikely to happen soon enough to matter. The Greeks not only have massive debts, but are still running big deficits. Trapped by an artificially strong currency, they cannot turn these deficits into surpluses, even if they do everything outsiders want them to do. Their exports, priced in euros, remain expensive. The German government wants the Greeks to slash the size of their government, but that will also slow economic growth and reduce tax revenues. And so one of two things must happen. Either the Germans must agree to integrate Europe fiscally, so that Germany and Greece bear the same relationship to each other as, say, Indiana and Mississippi. The tax dollars of ordinary Germans would go into a common coffer and be used to pay for the lifestyle of ordinary Greeks. Or the Greeks, and probably eventually every non-German, must introduce structural reform, a euphemism for magically and radically transforming themselves into a people as efficient and productive as the Germans. The first solution is pleasant for Greeks, but painful for Germans. The second solution is pleasant for Germans, but painful, possibly even suicidal for Greeks. The only economically plausible scenario is that the Germans, with a bit of help from a rapidly shrinking population of solvent European countries, suck it up, work harder, and pay for everyone else. But what is economically plausible appears to be politically unacceptable. The German people all know at least one fact about the euro, that before they agreed to trade in their Deutschmarks, their leaders promised them explicitly they would never be required to bail out other countries. The rule was created with the founding of the European Central Bank and was violated in 2010. Public opinion turns more against the violation every day, so much so that Chancellor Angela Merkel, who has a reputation for reading the public mood, hasn't even bothered to try to go before the German people to persuade them that it might be in their interest to help the Greeks. That is why Europe's money problems feel not just problematic, but intractable. It's why Greeks are now mailing bombs to Merkel, and thugs in Berlin are hurling stones through the windows of the Greek consulate. And it's why European leaders have done nothing but delay the inevitable reckoning by scrambling every few months to find cash to plug the ever-growing holes in Greece, Ireland, and Portugal, and praying that bigger and more alarming holes in Spain, Italy, and even France do not reveal themselves. Until now, the European Central Bank in Frankfurt has been the main source of this cash. The ECB was designed to behave with the same discipline as the German Bundesbank, but has been redesigned by the financial crisis into something else. Already it has bought outright something like $80 billion in Greek and Irish and Portuguese government bonds and lent another $450 billion or so to various European governments and European banks, accepting virtually any collateral, including Greek government bonds. But the ECB has a rule, and the Germans think the rule very important, that they cannot accept as collateral bonds classified by the U.S. rating agencies as in default. Given that the ECB once had a rule against buying bonds outright in the open market, and another rule against government bailouts, it's a little odd that they have gotten so hung up on this technicality. But they have. If Greece defaults on its debt, the ECB not only will lose a pile on its holdings of Greek bonds, but must return the bonds to the European banks, and the European banks must fork over $450 billion in cash. The ECB itself might face insolvency, which would mean turning for funds to its solvent member governments, led by Germany. The senior official at the Bundesbank told me, they have already thought about how to deal with the request. "We have 3,400 tons of gold," he said. "We are the only country that has not sold its original allotment from the late 1940s, so we are covered to some extent." The bigger problem with a Greek default is that it might well force other European countries and their banks themselves into default. At the very least, it would create panic and confusion in the market for both sovereign and bank debt at a time when a lot of banks in at least two big European debt-ridden countries, Italy and Spain, cannot afford panic and confusion. At the bottom of this unholy mess, from the point of view of the German finance ministry, is the unwillingness or inability of the Greeks to change their behavior. That was what the currency union always implied. Entire peoples had to change their way of life. Conceived as a tool for integrating Germany with Europe and preventing the Germans from dominating others, the euro had become the opposite. For better or worse, the Germans now control the financial fate of Europe. If the rest of Europe was to continue to enjoy the benefits of what was essentially a German currency, they'd need to become more German. And so, once again, all sorts of people who would rather not think about what it means to be German are compelled to do so. Jörg Asmussen offers the first hint of an answer in his personal behavior. He was a type familiar in Germany, but absolutely freakish in Greece, or for that matter, the United States. A keenly intelligent, highly ambitious civil servant who had no other ambition but to serve his country. His sparkling curriculum vitae was missing a line that would be found on the resumes of men in his position almost everywhere else in the world. The line where he leaves government service for Goldman Sachs to cash out. When I asked another prominent German civil servant why he hadn't taken time out of public service to make his fortune working for some bank, the way every American civil servant who is anywhere near finance seems to want to do, his expression changed to alarm. "But I could never do this," he said. "It would be illoyal." Asmussen echoes this sentiment when I ask him why he hasn't bothered to get rich. He then addresses the German question more directly. The curious thing about the eruption of cheap and indiscriminate lending of money between 2002 and 2008 was the different effects it had from country to country. Every developed country was subjected to more or less the same temptation, but no two countries responded in precisely the same way. Much of Europe had borrowed money cheaply to buy stuff it couldn't honestly afford. In effect, lots of non-Germans had used Germany's credit rating to indulge their material desires. The Germans were the exception. Given the chance to take something for nothing, the German people simply ignored the offer. "There was no credit boom in Germany," says Asmussen. Real estate prices were completely flat. There was no borrowing for consumption, because this behavior is totally unacceptable in Germany. This is what the German people are. This is deeply in German genes. It is perhaps a leftover of the collective memory of the Great Depression and the hyperinflation of the 1920s. The German government was equally prudent because, he went on, there is a consensus among the different parties about this. If you're not adhering to fiscal responsibility, you have no chance in elections, because the people are that way. In a moment of temptation, Germany became something like a mirror image to Iceland and Ireland and Greece and the United States. Other countries used foreign money to fuel various forms of insanity. The Germans, through their bankers, used their own money to enable foreigners to behave insanely. This is what makes the German case so peculiar. If they had been merely the only big developed nation with decent financial morals, they would present one sort of picture of simple rectitude. But they had done something far less common. During the boom, German bankers had gone out of their way to get dirty. They lent money to American subprime borrowers, to Irish real estate barons, to Icelandic banking tycoons, to do things that no German ever would do. The German losses are still being toted up, but at last count they stand at $21 billion in the Icelandic banks, $100 billion in Irish banks, $60 billion in various U.S. subprime-backed bonds, and some yet-to-be-determined amount in Greek bonds. The only financial disaster in the last decade German bankers appear to have missed was investing with Bernie Madoff, perhaps the only advantage to the German financial system of having no Jews. In their own country, however, these seemingly crazed bankers behaved with restraint. The German people did not allow them to behave otherwise. It was another case of clean on the outside, dirty on the inside. The German banks that wanted to get a little dirty needed to go abroad to do it. About this, the deputy finance minister has not that much to say, though he does wonder idly how a real estate crisis in Florida ends with massive financial losses in Germany. That such a thing has happened seems genuinely to puzzle him. A German economist named Henrik Enderlein, who teaches at the Hertie School of Governance in Berlin, has described the radical change that occurred in German banks beginning about 2003. In a paper in Progress, Enderlein points out, many observers initially believed German banks would be relatively less exposed to the crisis. The contrary turned out to be the case. German banks ended up being among the most affected in continental Europe, and this despite relatively favorable economic conditions. Everyone thought that German bankers were more conservative and more isolated from the outside world than, say, the French, and it wasn't true. There had never been any innovation in German banking, says Enderlein. You gave money to some company, and the company paid you back. They went virtually overnight from this to being American, and they weren't any good at it. What Germans did with money between 2003 and 2008 would never have been possible within Germany, as there was no one to take the other side of the many deals they did that made no sense. They lost massive sums in everything they touched, from U.S. subprime loans to Greek government bonds. Indeed, one view of the European debt crisis, the Greek street view, is that it is an elaborate attempt by the German government on behalf of its banks to get their money back without calling attention to what they are up to. The German government gives money to the European Union Rescue Fund so that it can give money to the Irish government, so that the Irish government can give money to Irish banks, so the Irish banks can repay their loans to the German banks. They are playing billiards, says Enderlein. The easier way to do it would be to give German money to the German banks and let the Irish banks fail. Why they don't simply do this is a question worth trying to answer. The 20-minute walk from the German finance ministry to the office of the chairman of Commerzbank, one of Germany's two giant private banks, is punctuated by officially sanctioned memories, the new Holocaust Memorial, 2.5 times the acreage occupied by the U.S. Embassy, the new street beside it called Hannah Arendt Street, the signs pointing to Berlin's new Jewish Museum, the park that contains the Berlin Zoo, where, after spending decades denying they had ever mistreated Jews, the authorities have newly installed on the Antelope House a plaque commemorating their Nazi-era expropriation of shares in the zoo owned by Jews. Along the way, you also pass Hitler's bunker, but you'd never know it was there, as it has been paved over by a parking lot, and the small plaque that commemorates it is well hidden. The streets of Berlin can feel like an elaborate shrine. It's as if history stopped and assigned roles to people, and the Germans have been required to accept that they will always play the villain. On the other hand, it's easier to express contrition about just about everything the less personally responsible one feels. The guilt is being so loudly expressed precisely because it is no longer personal and searing. Hardly anyone still alive is responsible for what happened here. Everyone is. But when everyone is guilty, no one is. At any rate, if some Martian landed on the streets of Berlin knowing nothing of its history, he might wonder, who are these people called the Jews, and how did they come to run this place? But there are no Jews in Germany, or not many. The German people never see Jews, says Gary Smith, the director of the American Academy in Berlin. Jews are unreal to them. When they think of Jews, they think of victims. The further away the German people get from their victims, the more conspicuously they commemorate them. Of course, no German in his right mind actually wants to sit around remembering the terrible crimes committed by his ancestors. And there are signs, including the memorials, that they are finding ways to move on. A good friend of mine, a Jew whose family was driven out of Germany in the 1930s, recently visited a German consulate in the United States to apply for a passport. He already held one European passport, but he worried that the European Union might one day fall apart, and he wanted access to Germany just in case. The German official in charge, an Aryan out of Central Casting, wearing a Sound of Music vest, handed him a copy of a pamphlet titled A Jew's Life in Modern Germany. "Would you mind if we take a picture?" he asked my friend after processing his passport application. "No problem," said my friend.
"Can we do it in front of the flag?" asked the official.
My friend stared at the German flag. "What's this for?" he asked.
"Our website," said the German official,
then added that the government hoped to post the photo with a sign that read, "This man is the descendant of Holocaust survivors, and he has decided to return to Germany." Commerce Bank was the first private bank that the German government had to rescue during the financial crisis, with an injection of $25 billion. But that's not why it had caught my attention. I'd been walking around Frankfurt one night with a German financier when I noticed